reach for. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for a thousand years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. War this way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. My wife and I have been watching a Korean TV series recently, The Great Queen Sondok. The whole thing is in Korean with subtitles, so I had to pay close attention for all 62 episodes. The series is based on historical events. It's an incredible story. I recommend it to those of you that have streaming Netflix, and a lot of patience. Here's why I'm telling you about it. You know, we tend to think the Project for the New American Century, the CIA, all the rest of the American prison military industrial complex have the corner on false flag attacks. Assassinations, internal and external, fake communications, intrigue of all sorts. Well, this series reminded me that that kind of stuff has been going on a very, very long time. Countries all over the world. Silla, that's one of the three parts of Korea back then. Silla in the 7th century was an example that rivals anything in Greek, Roman, or British history that most of us are a little bit more familiar with. Perhaps it even surpasses them. Might even surpass today's corpocracy. Is that hypocrisy? Well, corpocracy. Corporate something. For sheer audacity and manipulation. It was really an eye-opener. But, you know, just the fact that there's precedent for this level of corruption doesn't mean that we should just accept it today. We have to fight it at every turn, at every level. Right now, politicos are posturing as they try to get us to vote for them this fall. It's yet another match of a horrible candidate running against one who's even worse. You know, if the possibilities didn't seem so awful, I definitely wouldn't vote. But, you know, it's widely accepted that very active voting is an acceptance of the way things are, so I really don't want to do it. But if I don't vote, how am I going to feel if suddenly women lose their right to birth control? If they're expected to if they get raped, if they're expected to carry a child to term. That doesn't seem right. It seems there are major steps backward that could happen. Would I think, hey, I really should have voted against that guy? I probably would think that. The lesser of two evils is still evil, though. Yeah, that's clear. But, hey, it is the lesser evil. So I'll probably choose to cast my vote, although I have to hold my nose the whole time, but probably have to go for the guy that's in there now. I'd rather choose not to vote or to vote for Jill Stein, but I don't think I'm going to be able to talk myself into it. Thing is, the last time around, the last presidential elections, I voted with hope. This time, it's disgust. It's desperation. So it goes. But enough about the big issues. Tonight, we're going to focus on some smaller issues, well, at least part of the time. Well, these issues, if they're not smaller, at least they don't get as much attention. Of course, if you were a homeless person and you didn't fit into the mold created by society, you might think that our policymakers' mental health policies were pretty darn important. That's what I'm going to talk about with Paul Gianfrido. He, as it happens, helped to shape some of those policies for the state of Connecticut, at least. I think it's going to be a very interesting interview. Our second guest, Sherwood Ross, needs no introduction to regular listeners. His column is always insightful and thoroughly researched. I thank you all for tuning in to the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm Chuck Gregory, and I have a dream of a better America, a better world, or, as Bill Hicks put it, a better ride. Let's listen.
It's just a ride, and we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
Let's build our New American Dream one step at a time. It's my pleasure to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hey, Chuck. As you mentioned, tonight will be our special guest will be Paul Gianfrido, and he'll be speaking to us from Middletown, Connecticut, and Sherwood Ross will be speaking to us from Fort Lauderdale. So we're coming to you from Duluth, Fort Lauderdale, and Middletown, Connecticut, and then you, wherever you are. Jim Fetzer, who I've spoken of many times, sent us some information. He said this might be a possible interest to your readers and listeners. So Jim has three articles on Veterans Today. One is called 9/11 and Zion, What Was Israel's Role? Another one is 9/11 Confessions of a Former CIA Asset by Susan Lindauer with Jim Fetzer. And another one is 9/11 J'accuse, if I can pronounce that correctly. In that, Fetzer accuses Zelikow, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush, and O'Brien of masterminding 9/11. The federal minimum wage is just $7.25 an hour. It hasn't been raised in 3 years. But a raise is much more overdue than that. If we look at the minimum wage 44 years ago and simply adjust it for inflation, it would be more than $10 today. This is another ugly symptom of what has gone wrong in America over the past 35 to 40 years. There is currently legislation before Congress to raise the federal minimum wage from its current $7.25 to $9.80 over 3 years. After that, it would be indexed to inflation. Contrary to prevailing myths about who would benefit from a proposed increase in the minimum wage, 88% of the 28 million workers affected are not teenagers. As the Economic Policy Institute has shown, the majority are full-time workers, and on average they earn about half of their family's income. And 28% of the nation's 76 million children would have a parent who would benefit from the raise. The Economic Policy Institute estimated that the proposed increase in the minimum wage would actually increase employment. In Brazil, the minimum wage was raised by 60% in real terms by the country's most popular president, Lula da Silva, a former metal worker and union leader, as Brazil's economy moved toward record low levels of unemployment. Across South America, other left governments, including Argentina, Ecuador, Bolivia, Venezuela, and more, have significantly reduced inequality while increasing economic growth. What a shame that the hemisphere's richest country, where it would be so much easier to lift up the working poor, has moved in the opposite direction. It means that the U.S. political system is actually more corrupt and less democratic in very important ways than those of our developing country neighbors to the south. The vast majority of Americans would favor an increase in the minimum wage, as well as restoring the rights to labor to organize unions. But our financial elite have a veto over what we want to vote for, in large part because of our system of legalized bribery, that is, the financing of political candidates' elections. Raising the minimum wage is about the minimum that we could do to reverse America's retreat from civilization at home. And to read the rest of that article by Mark Wiesbrot, you can Google minimum wage raise is the least we can do to civilize America. Mark Wiesbrot, W-E-I-S-B-R-O-T. And also, I'd like to mention something, another thing from Jill Stein. They're in kind of a hurry-up mode to finance their some TV ads they want to get on the air. And if you can go to Jill Stein, the Green Party, you can find out how to do that, how to help them out there. And also, if you'll go to Howling for Wolves, Howling for Wolves, that's another website I'd like to mention. It's there will be a wolf hunting season in Minnesota beginning November 3rd, and there are those who are trying a last-ditch attempt contacting the governor to try and get him to stop that the wolf hunting season. So go to Howling for Wolves. It is again time for the New American Dream Radio Show, the American-Russian novel All We Need Is More Vodka Radio Hour. Because we have the winds of our own totalitarian society freezing the land solid, a tortured tundra. Some of those who have spoken the truth are no longer here. Their chairs at the Thanksgiving adult big table are empty. Their relatives have sent them to Siberia with a roll of their eyes. So let us begin. Here we go. Scooch up to the samovar. Maybe leave your hat and boots on. Fill your peasant hands with a warm drink. And listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice. The New American Dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There is no hidden black military budget, no UFO files Americans cannot see, no JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes, no destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we could even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing the United States politicians, journalists, and generals who have brought about this long war to trial and put on TV just like OJ every afternoon so every American can watch. just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now we live on lies. We subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they all know that, and yet they refuse to acknowledge what they know. They kill and continue to kill. They allow others to die and continue to send others to their deaths for a lie. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. Our country is surely broken as well. We need a truth commission. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. The troops are not protecting us. That is someone's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They are not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face to face with the empire. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. He is complicit. He has lied. He has continued the wars based on a lie, and he knows he is lying. He lied right to our faces on national television when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 and 2004 elections. And see, there is a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. If you look really close, it went all the way into the hole, and no, there's no blood and no bodies and no luggage scattered or plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those came from persons within our own government. It's like a horror movie, and the killer is still in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us, and they want us to be afraid, but we cannot be afraid.
And now, we bring you the New American Dream Masterpiece Classic Playhouse Theater something something. Real voices with a message you'll not hear on the CBS Nightly News. Here's Bruce Cockburn, musician and songwriter. "Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say. If I had a rocket launcher, I'd make somebody pay. I don't believe in guarded borders. I don't believe in hate. I don't believe in generals or their stinking torture states. And when I talk with the survivors of things too sickening to relate, if I had a rocket launcher, I would retaliate. On the Rio Lincoln tune, 100,000 wait to fall down from starvation or some less humane fate. Cry for Guatemala with a corpse in every gate. If I had a rocket launcher, I would not hesitate. I want to raise every voice. At least I've got to try. Every time I think about it, water rises to my eyes. Situation desperate. Echoes of the victims cry. If I had a rocket launcher, some son of a bitch would die." James McMurtry, singer-songwriter. "Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line, flag on the wheelchair, flapping in the breeze, one leg missing, both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, VA budget stretched so thin, and there's more coming home from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. See all those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just going to sit there till they rot. Because there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack. Just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts round the square. There's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. you don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender, you don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you got to have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far $5.15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. Bet you can't make it here anymore. High school girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine. She found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. She comes up pregnant. What will she do? Forget the career? Forget about school? Can she live on faith? Live on hope? High on Jesus or hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Now I'm stocking shirts in the Walmart store, just like the ones we made before, except this one came from Singapore. Guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now. They haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want. They'll never know need. Their shit don't stink and their kids won't bleed. Their kids won't bleed in the damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. We'll work for food. We'll die for oil. We'll kill for power. And to us, the spoils. The billionaires get to pay less tax. The working poor get to fall through the cracks. Let them eat jelly beans. Let them eat cake. Let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. And that's how it is. That's what we got. The president wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo. Look us in the eye. Call us on the cell phone. Tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or cotton gin, out on the great high plains. That's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here anymore.
We wish to give a shout out to those listening in on the Armed Forces Network tonight. Ships at sea, military bases in 9,000 countries around the world, the U.S. Special Forces snipers in the Khyber Pass in Afghanistan, the Oakland Police Department, the correctional officers in Terre Haute Federal Penitentiary, the Immigrant Detention Center in Phoenix, the COINTELPRO spies in the Minneapolis Occupy Movement, the BOP snitches in the Chicago Metropolitan Correctional Center, and the Homeland Security undercover lunch ladies in the kitchen of Regis Jesuit High School in Denver. Thank you all for the work you do in keeping us all safe and able to worship at any church that we want to, and sitting wherever we want to in that particular church or synagogue or teepee, and having the freedom that not everyone has around the world of taking whatever street we want to take, any route whatsoever, to get to that place of worship. And when we get to that place of God or Yahweh or Buddha or Bubba or Alan the Alien or the Almighty Sun God, that we, and not everyone in the world has the freedom to do this, to park wherever we want to in that particular parking lot that we choose our own selves as Americans. And then when we walk to that building or teepee or grass hut or adobe temple, something, something, that we can walk in single file or as a group to that particular church or place of worship as free Americans. Thank you for all that you do and for tuning in and for killing who needs to be killed and locking up however many people need to be locked up, so that the rest of us can be free, free as Americans. And not everyone has the freedom to do that, to go to church and then go home and pig out and watch the football game and then take a nap and get up and eat a little bit more. Thank you for your service. You are our heroes and protectors. Amen.
Our first guest tonight, Paul Gianfrido, has been a mayor, a six-term state legislator, policy consultant and a nonprofit executive during his career. He's focused on public health, mental health, children's health, community health, primary care, and long-term care policy. And tonight we're going to be talking about mental health policy. And I welcome you to the show. Paul, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'd like you to tell our listeners a little bit about the essay that you recently had published discussing the failures in mental health policies.
I'd be happy to. Health Affairs has published this essay in the September issue of the Health Policy Journal, which is the leading health policy journal in the nation. And the story I tell in the essay is the story of 20 years of my son Timothy's life with mental illness. He developed mental illness at a very early age. He was 5 or 6 years old when he began to show the first symptoms. And this isn't unusual. About half the people who have serious mental illness develop it by the time they're the age of 14. But what happened to Tim is the story of what's happened to so many of our children who do develop mental illnesses, especially serious ones. He was educated poorly in the schools. The services that he was provided didn't work. The kinds of cutbacks that we began to make when I was in the state legislature in Connecticut many, many years ago, and it continued to this day in state governments, led to poor services and really a life which has now led Tim into the revolving door of hospitalization, incarceration, and homelessness. And I like to tell people, Tim isn't homeless because he has mental illness. He's homeless because of the way we've treated his mental illness.
I've met a number of people with who are homeless because of mental illness, and it's a very big problem. For many of them, it occurred somewhat later in life. A lot of them are veterans, for instance.
Yes. Yes, you know, veterans are especially susceptible to the very serious mental illness called post-traumatic stress disorder. But so are a lot of other people. In fact, about 7% of people overall in the United States do have diagnosable post-traumatic stress disorder, but as many as 80% of Vietnam veterans may, in fact, at some point in their lives have had some symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, their rates, even to this day, run between 15 and 25%. So serious mental illness is a big problem for young adults, but it is a surprisingly big problem for children as well. And many of those people that you see who are homeless as adults because of mental illness, and most chronically homeless people do have some kind of a behavioral health disorder. A lot of those occurred or began when they were children, but it takes generally about 10 years from the time that the symptoms first appear to the time that people get an accurate diagnosis. And by then it's often too late to intervene effectively and to get effective treatments going.
I guess by that time they've probably gone a long way into the self-medication syndromes and as a result ended up in jail once or twice or more, maybe beaten up by the cops. Does that sound pretty accurate?
That sounds very accurate. Again, these are anecdotes that I've included in the essay that I wrote about Tim's life. And the truth of it is that by the time the symptoms are properly diagnosed, oftentimes this is really the only reality that the person knows. So even if you provide a medication, as Timothy used to say to me, Dad, they make me feel too even. And I said, well, what do you mean, Tim, too even? And he would say, well, they kind of make me like you. And, you know, but that's not me. I'm more up and down. And so he was used to that. And when he wasn't used to it, when the voices in his head became too great, then the pharmaceuticals that he would take didn't work as well frankly, as marijuana did. And so, but you know what happens if people take marijuana, you know, you get arrested for that. So Timothy has, in fact, ended up in that revolving door where now he often gets arrested for things that you and I wouldn't get arrested for, like sitting or lying on a sidewalk or loitering. You know, we can stand and talk on a street corner, but if a homeless person tries to do that, the police often pick them up. And in Tim's case, you know, when they used to try to pick him up for that, he'd often try to run away. And when he tried to run away, they'd chase him and tackle him. And one time he landed in the hospital because of that, even though he wasn't charged with anything that time. So it does become a very vicious cycle for these people.
You mentioned that you were one of the policymakers that created some of the of this current situation. Could you elaborate on that? And then also tell us what might be done differently.
Sure, I'd be happy to. When I was in the state legislature, it was the late 1970s and throughout the 1980s. And our view at the time was that our state mental hospitals, our state psychiatric institutions were in such disrepair and the programming was so poor that people would be better off in the community, even if we didn't fully fund the community services. The problem with that thinking was that, you know, oftentimes no services are worse than bad ones. And that helped create the problem of homelessness that we have today. And that problem is exacerbated by today's policymakers because in just the last 3 years alone, I've pointed out, state legislatures, state governments across the nation have cut $3.4 billion from state mental health services. And these were already services that were underfunded. And so they've continued to fund them even less. In my home state, your home state, Florida, we're 49th in spending for mental illness. And in Texas, the state I lived in before that, we were 50th in funding of mental health services. So the most immediate thing we can do to turn this around is to spend a little more. And, you know, this obviously is not what policymakers want to hear these days and what not a lot of the rest of us want to hear. But what we don't understand is we're paying the price just as they are. They pay it first because they end up with lives like Timothy. But who pays the bill when Tim is incarcerated? Who pays the bill when Tim is hospitalized? We all do. And so if we put more money into community services, if we adopt the Medicaid expansion that's now been made an option by the Supreme Court under the Affordable Care Act, if we got rid of some of these laws that are what I call status offense laws for people who are homeless with mental illness, loitering laws, if we got rid of the no sitting or lying on a sidewalk, these absurd things that we've put into place just so the police can pick these people up and put them in our jails, and parenthetically, the three largest mental health institutions in the country are often said to be right now Rikers Island, the LA County Jail, and the Cook County Jail by actual count of people with mental illness in them. So if we just got some brains and put our head properly on our shoulders and looked at this differently in terms of what it's doing to them and to us as a society, we could do a lot better, a lot more easily.
Well, that certainly makes sense. Of course, spending money isn't something that people like to do, as you said.
Yeah, but you can pay me now or you can pay me later. You know, we're going to pay,
well,
we pay the
true
price either way. You know, and so the fact that Timothy has spent most of the last year in jail, if people don't think they haven't been paying that bill, and when he wasn't in jail and he was in the hospital, if they don't think they weren't paying that bill, we would have been a lot better off if we had invested a little bit more money into providing the proper educational supports for him when he was still in school so he could have survived in school and not been kicked out of school after school. And we would have been a lot better off if we had provided adequate housing support to him in the community and actually a little bit of effort toward helping him develop some job skills, which is really all he ever wanted to do, live by himself, leave people alone, have a job that he could go to. And that was his aspiration, stuff that didn't happen. So all those things, I think we could all agree, would have been a whole lot better than what we've got now, a 27-year-old who is in this boat and will be essentially for the rest of his days unless we change the way we think about this and change what we do about this.
Well, I certainly hope that you can get some people to listen and try to make some changes with these policies. And, well, we'll try to get the word out here.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We're almost out of time, but Mike has sent me a question to ask you. He wants to know if the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest had anything to do with changing the public attitudes towards mental illness.
You know, I think that that movie and anything that is in the mass media do help or sometimes hurt in terms of changing attitudes about mental illness. And I think that that movie certainly was one that when I was younger, you know, we looked at and said, okay, you know, we need to do something about the, we'll call it the craziness of what goes on in these institutionalized settings. And that, of course, had a lot of the – that was almost allegorical in terms of its rebellion against authority, you know, that you know, aspect
Absolutely.
Of what was in that movie that kind of fit with the time we were much younger. And, you know, but the truth of the matter is that most depictions of people with mental illness in the media work against the people who actually have mental illness, because in the media representations of people with mental illness, they're often seen as the perpetrators of violence. But in real life, people with mental illness are more commonly the victims of violence.
That's absolutely true. And that's been my observation on a personal level with many people that I have known.
Yeah.
Thank you for a very informative interview. And I hope maybe you'll speak to us again sometime. This is I really appreciate your sharing this with us, and it was really a great thing that you wrote that essay, and I'm going to make sure I include a link on our website.
Well, that's great.
So,
I do appreciate it, and any time, I'll be happy to talk with you further about it.
Well, thank you very much, Paul, and have a good night.
Okay, you too.
Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker Television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe, Fallujah, Waco, OKC, Paul Wellstone, Bobby Kennedy. We started the fire. The world was just turning, but it wasn't burning. We didn't like it. We just had to light it. Shock and Awe, Toby Keith, Schwarzkopf, Colin Powell, Fire in the Hole. Guatemala, Chile, Vietnam, Desert Storm, Guantanamo. Malcolm, MLK, Florida, Ohio, Vote Stolen by Bush. 9/11, Inside Job, Northwoods, Nicaragua, Panama, El Salvador. Attica, Terre Haute, Leavenworth, Lewisburg, Marion, Rikers Island, Lompoc, Folsom, Angola, San Quentin, Florence, Colorado, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Harry Truman, Paul Tibbetts, Gene Kirkpatrick, Gerald Ford, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Rush Limbaugh, drone murder in Pakistan, bombs on Baghdad, Afghan, Iran, fighter jet, Super Bowl, grassy knoll, Obama, no change, he's in the CIA, JFK, blown away. What else do I have to say?
Occupy, Dealey Plaza. It's where it all began. November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m., 50 years ago, next year, November 22nd, 2013, filled Dealey Plaza with protesters and signs and singing and speaking. Let them bring their dogs and their cops and their robbers and murderers and their sniper rifles and double secret video cameras and microphones. Occupy Dealey Plaza. We demand a truth commission to replace the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission. We want freedom, We want peace. We want real hope and real change. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let them know we know what they have done. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let the world know this is America.
Some people honestly believe that when the Green Bay Packers offense goes and walks 10 yards from the ball and gets into a secret circle, that they are planning something, that they have something to hide from the Chicago Bears. Those people are conspiracy nuts, crazed wackos who hate cheese. Some people think that when George Bush and Dick Cheney fought against having the 9/11 attacks investigated, and then later only would meet with the investigative group together and without a transcript of that meeting being made, that they had something to hide. Green Bay is a lovely city with good people and cheese. They obviously have nothing to hide. George Bush and Dick Cheney are highly educated, prosperous leaders in America. They obviously have nothing to hide. We are also proud to be sponsored this evening by Dumb Guys Hunting, Hunting Guides of Dubuque. Are you a dumb guy? You want to go hunting? There you go. Give us a call. We'll go with you. We are Dumb Guys Hunting, Hunting Guides of Dubuque. And now available at all Walgreens, Walmart, and Cenex stores, a new self-help booklet from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, because reading makes a great country great. You might be a conspiracy theorist, wacko, nutcase, dumbass, failure, jerk-off, homo, big fatty, if you wonder what happened to the passengers on 9/11. If you wonder where was the plane at the Pentagon. If you wonder where was the plane in the plane crash at Shanksville. You might be a conspiracy theorist, wacko, nutcase, dumbass, failure, jerk-off, homo, big fatty, if you saw the North and South Towers go down and wondered if that's really how a falling building looks like when it falls down, if you wonder why President Bush did not want to investigate 9/11 and did not want to talk to the 9/11 Commission by himself, were they meeting in the dark with spiders? You might be a conspiracy theorist, wacko, nutcase, dumbass, failure, jerk-off, homo, big fatty, if you wonder why they have not shown us 1 million times on Chevy commercials and the Super Bowl halftime the plane hitting the Pentagon with the hundreds of cameras that were watching that building. And you might be a conspiracy theorist, wacko, nutcase, dumbass, failure, jerk-off, homo, big fatty, if you wonder why Bill Clinton or Barack Obama are not the least bit interested in investigating 9/11.
Our second guest tonight is our regular radio columnist, Sherwood Ross. Sherwood's a veteran journalist who now directs the Anti-War News Service. His reporting and commentary on political and military topics appear on hundreds of internet sites globally.
Pull down your hats, folks, because it looks like Uncle Sam is trying to take over the world. Not just the ground we walk on either, but the oceans, the skies, and even outer space as well. What the Pentagon wants is what they call full-spectrum dominance of the planet. During the Second World War, Americans were told that if the Germans broke the Russian lines at Stalingrad and the Japanese broke the British lines in Burma, those two Axis nations would hook up in India and rule the world. But that never happened. Today, however, the U.S. sphere of influence is greater than the Germans and the Japanese combined during World War II. Using its 1,000 overseas bases, its roving, far-flung navies, and its own troops and the troops of its allies, the U.S. pretty much controls the planet, except for Russia, China, and Iran. To begin with, the U.S. runs a five-nation intelligence network called Echelon. Its partners in this enterprise are Great Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. They share everything, information, everything. They are closer than thieves. And you can count all of them in the American sphere. In fact, the U.S. and Great Britain are really one country, even if they're separated by an ocean. Only the capital of the country got transferred from London to Washington a couple of hundred years ago, but they act as one. The U.S. can also count in its sphere of influence Japan and South Korea. In Japan, the U.S. has been paying off political leaders of the ruling party for years. I mean, it's been an open scandal. And if you've ever wondered where your tax dollars are going, Politics Today magazine once reported that the U.S. bought 5,000 Brazilian politicians in just one election. Next, the U.S. runs NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance organization. It was formed during the Cold War to defend Europe and the Soviets, and it has swollen to include 28 countries, all of which must be counted as America's allies. With the Soviets gone, NATO is not needed anymore. And despite its pledge, it would go no further than the German border. NATO today is conducting operations in the Atlantic, the Arctic, the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, the Mediterranean, and the Gulf of Aden. On the ground, NATO is displaying its military muscle on four continents: in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Sudan, and the former Yugoslavia. You'd think that since the old Soviet Union closed up shop, NATO might close down too. But that's not how it works anymore. Years ago, the Soviet Union shut down its germ warfare operation. But U.S. research in germ warfare is going full blast, including research on many college campuses. In the past decade, more than $50 billion in taxpayers' dollars has gone down the drain for this loathsome and disgusting purpose. And if you've ever wondered where Lyme disease came from, and if you wonder where West Nile virus may be coming from, try one of those U.S. Department of Agriculture research centers run by the Pentagon. Well, getting back to how the U.S. is out to control the world, it has come to pass that many important decisions in Mexico these days are actually being made in Washington. And Mexican officials can plead all they want for the U.S. to legalize drugs, to take the profit out of the drug trade. But Washington is not doing that. And the drug trade in Mexico is expanding. And many Mexicans are being killed as the country is turned into a lawless jungle. Same business in Afghanistan. When the U.S. installed its good friend Hamid Karzai to run the country, he promised the poppy fields would be shut down in a year. Well, the reports say that last year's crop of poppies was a bumper crop. It was the biggest in history. And who would be surprised if the Central Intelligence Agency, so active in that country, wasn't adding a little to its black budget, the budget that is not reported to Congress, in money coming from those poppy fields, the same way it got money from the Golden Triangle in the Far East years ago. So the CIA may be putting poppies in their buttonholes. Speaking of Afghanistan, don't you think it's odd that a war in that country has gone on for so long? After all, the U.S. beat the great powers of Japan and Germany and their Italian buddies in less than 4 years. And here the U.S. has been fighting little Afghanistan for more than a decade. Has the suspicion crossed anybody's mind that maybe the U.S. does not want to win that war, that maybe the war comes in handy for justifying that fabulous $1 trillion so-called defense budget every year. If you wanted the Afghan insurgents to stop fighting us, wouldn't you stop the drone warfare strikes? Every time one of those strikes killed innocent civilians, it only increases the hatred of Afghans for Americans. The same is true of Pakistan. The same is true of Somalia. You and I may not profit from the war, but the universities getting germ warfare research grants are collecting. So are the defense contractors, hundreds of them. They are enjoying record multi-billion dollar profits. They have never had it so good. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? If you're a defense contractor, man, you can say yes. And by the way, can you guess which arms peddler now controls 70 to 80% of all the armament sales in the world? Yeah, it's the same country which added 700,000 more households last year to the list of those households that were short of food. That's right. A record 18 million American households didn't have enough food last year to sustain active, healthy lives, according to a new report just out from the Agriculture Department. And that included 9 million American children. There is money for drone strikes in Pakistan because the government is ignoring 50 million Americans living in poverty. 50 million Americans. You hear a lot from both political parties about helping the middle class, but I have yet to hear one word. I've yet to hear the word poor spoken at either the Democrat or Republican conventions. A lot of American people think the poor are poor because they're just lazy. They don't recognize that the poor in this country do the hardest, dirtiest work in our society. And a lot of people are living in poverty. They're nothing more than wage slaves who work two or three jobs, and they are still poor. If you only took the billions the U.S. spends on NATO and spent it on housing vouchers so that the poor could move into good housing, if you only took the billions the U.S. spends on germ warfare and devoted it to vocational training for the unskilled workers. If. So, how does it feel to rule the world? I'm Sherwood Ross. Good night to every one of you.
This message brought to you by the Boogeyman. The United States of America has a huge military and hundreds of bases around the world that the people were told for 50 years were needed exclusively to counter one enemy, communism. And now, there aren't any communists anymore. CIA needed to be so huge to counter the KGB, but there isn't any KGB anymore. The FBI need to be so huge because the Reds were everywhere, even under our beds. But there aren't any Reds anymore. So we don't need the military and the bases and the CIA and FBI, right? Yeah. No. There are terrorists everywhere. They attacked us on 9/11. And there are big bees from Mexico. And so there you go. We still need almost all your money. Have a nice day. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. And please believe what we tell you. Bye.
Just in this late breaking news brief, the House Un-American Activities Committee will be reconvening next week. The committee will be investigating un-American activities such as the murder of children in Iraq and Afghanistan and the restricting of personal freedoms through the so-called Patriot Act, as well as the infiltration of American organizations by members of clandestine terror groups. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Central Intelligence Agency? Appearing next week before the committee will be Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Katie Couric, Diane Sawyer, Brian Williams, and in absentia, Peter Jennings.
And make sure to watch this next Wednesday night on CBS after the news. Are you smarter than the Border Patrol?
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Kate King is the daughter of Jack Robert King and Cherry King, and Johnny King was her brother. A while back, you might recall, you might not, that Jack Robert King took his online podcast radio show on the road. He rode a bus from Nebraska to Oregon. He said he was looking for Bigfoot. Maybe we'll be able to find out more about that story later. We're trying to. But he wasn't just going to Oregon to see if he could have a Bigfoot experience. He also wanted to find out the truth about America. He just felt in his gut that he didn't know the whole story and he had to know. Well, he found out at least something, at least more than he knew before. And what we do know is that after he returned, well, a few weeks or months later, he and Cherry and Johnny were dead and the radio show was no more. Little Kate saw the whole thing. She saw it all and she ran. She ran into the corn that afternoon and she lived. And she suffered and she survived and she learned. And today, she's very, very angry and very, very beautiful and very, very capable and so very alive.
The only problem with the running of the nation was the girl who had lived. The family lay in the road, in the gravel and dust, in their own blood. The three sprawled in not human poses, arms and elbows, legs sprayed out as if forced into unnatural forms by the men who made the nation. The father and mother and brother with their faces covered in blood, noses shoved into the black earth, eyes and mouths open, filled with mucus and wonder and disbelief, just as it should be. The little girl had died, all be well. All would be awesome. Nation's gears growled, screamed, enormous, oiled, cleverly meshed, showing signs of human genius. They ran and never stopped, but that could not go on forever because the little girl had lived and she grew stronger. Her bones and her blood would one day become stronger even than gears and oil and grease. They beat and they grew and they knew because that's what bones and blood can do. The little girl ran at first, but only for a while. She would turn and face her pursuers. Then they would become afraid because they saw the green steel in her eye. Those who ran the nation looked for her every day, all the time. The work continued. Every dawn of a new day in the nation dripped with immense possibility. Now the little girl was almost grown. She stalked the nation, circled its campground in the night like an undiscovered wild animal.
Kate walked into the Quick Stop and rushed to the pens by the gum. At the counter, she stood behind two women waving little flags in front of their faces, whispering about eyeshadow, subconsciously lauding all the good done by the prison system. Without looking, Kate opened the plastic wrapper, slicing it with a red fingernail. She measured where the one woman's spleen might be through her thick corduroy coat. The women giggled at each other and the clerk and moved off out the door. Kate stepped up, now eyeing the plastic jar by the register that asked people to donate for a holiday package for the troops. Kate took her new red pen and drew a swastika on the white paper. Unsure if the cross Z's were quite right, she shrugged. young man behind the counter watched her and said, $1.47. Kate picked up her guitar case and left. On the walk, she adjusted down her white twins cap with blood-red lettering and straightened her black cape with another shrug. Kate moved on with long, powerful, limping strides, back straight, eyes ahead. When passing men and boys stopped to stare, she acted as if she did not notice.
The crowd on the curbs grew like a swarming beehive. Soon the low sun would turn its back and leave snipers to their business. A shocking fire engine horn blared somewhere down the street. The motorcade would not be long now. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the spot and went for it, glad for the chance to rest her burning leg. Kate found her perch, all planned out weeks ago after she read about the big visit. She stopped, letting the hurried foot traffic find its path around her. Kate sat on the curb and rubbed dirt off her favorite red tennis shoes. She leaned back against the barren, round concrete planter and opened a guitar case flat on the sidewalk on one side of her. And on the other side, she set her coffee, staking a steaming claim to the space. She drew her weapons from the case, the white page notebook, the sleeve of pens on the walk. She closed the case and set it down just so that on one side across the street, the people with their flags could see the 9/11 was an inside job sign in red ink and black border on white paper. And the folks behind her saw, "This machine kills fascists."
With pens, red, blue, black, green, purple, now in her hands, behind her ears, in her mouth, on the sidewalk, in the street, Kate took her left hand and touched the clean white pad pressed against one bent knee aimed down the street. She sighted over the pad and began to sketch the wide street, the crowds on both sides, each leaning to get a look around the next person, the walkway over the street connecting the corporate bookstore to the city bank building. Kate drew big, dark clouds overhead, and inside the clouds, big, thick, black words around the edges of her canvas. Doom, despair, Dickensian, poverty, war, Tolstoyan, unfairness, Dostoevskian, misery, deceit.
On her side of the street, she gave birth to a family standing together, exchanging looks of anticipation with each other. At the far end of the street and strobing police lights, the mother, father, son, daughter appeared Neanderthal, with low, deep brow ridges over the eyes, like caves. They sprouted tufts of hair in unlikely places on the back of their wrists and on their faces. Each wore either a gold or silver cross around their necks on a chain. They wore red, white, and blue buttons on their white-shirted chests that said murder. They darted nervous monkey looks all around and swayed their long arms, whispering, hissing, "Murder, murder, murder." In their big, hairy hands, they sloppily held American flags on tiny sticks. Kate adjusted her bottom on the cool cement and curled her toes inside her shoes, staring yet harder at her paper world. She would have said she liked her green eyes like green lanterns, fiery gems, fiendish, inquiring, the one open and laughing, the other devilish. She tugged at her cap and narrowed her eyes, aiming a laser down the street. Children dashed back and forth, gaining advantage over rivals for candy tosses. There'd be no candy today. Kate had silently given herself the nickname Avenger. She'd considered getting a superhero tattoo on her lower back or maybe her neck. Kate's long hair glistened thick and black. She had a cheerleader homecoming queen face, with revolutionary Russian coffee shop eyes, erotic, piercing, doubting.
Her black cape buttoned around her neck, she wore black half gloves, home fashioned, cut off at the knuckles. She wore her cap proudly. It was her dad's, white with red twins letters, adjustable. The cover of her worn artist pad pictured a stick person drawing in ink a large Bigfoot. On the first inside page was another sketch, more like a child's doodling of a group of three people stretched on a road with a helicopter above them and dot bullets raining from it. A cornfield runs along the road and a stick figure little girl stands in the corn with dots of tears falling down her face. Kate drew the new red pen from her mouth. On the top of her fresh drawing, she wrote, "Vengeance," large letters across the page, a banner headline. She underlined it, and then again, and again. She filled in the letters and traced them again, wider, deeper, darker. Three black and white police cars appeared under the walkway, side by side across the street, lights flashing. Behind them came a like phalanx of fire engines with horns blaring, honking, like inherently angry geese.
They sat for a moment beneath the walkway, where an enterprising rifle person should be sitting, aiming, squeezing off round after round, thought Kate. But the thick glass was vacant, shatterproof likely, triple ply, truth resistant. Kate filled in the scene on her pad as quickly as she could manage, switching colors in a flurry, not noticing a group that had formed behind her, blowing breath puffs like a cattle yard in January, pawing, digging into cement with cold feet, stuffing hands deeper into pockets, leaning hunched shoulders forward to see what the street artist was doing. "She's not very good," a girl told her father, who shrugged and looked up at the new sound. A cheer, crescendo, a wave of voices rolling, crashing, breaking along both sides of the street. The police cars and fire engines and horns and lights inched forward, gradually revealing a third layer, a four-wide cabal, shoulder-to-shoulder black limousines with tiny American flags fluttering from the front quarter panels. Kate tried to stare a laser beam into the closed, darkened windshields of the vehicles, but still they kept coming. Kate drew carefully as best she could, hurrying, sweating, needing to stop the progress of the parade. She concocted a woman standing in the middle of the street, fists dug hard into her sides, feet wide, just staring straight into the flashing lights of the oncoming motorcade parade. A black cape fluttered from her shoulders, her long black hair stretched out behind her likewise in the steady northwest breeze. She showed off a Bigfoot tattoo around her belly button. She wore a red mask over her eyes and black lipstick and rings on seven of her fingers. She wore cherry red tennis shoes and jeans torn at the knees. Her white tight T-shirt pictured an American flag, and in bold, thick red letters, "Progressive Avenger." Kate drew more slowly. She smiled at her work. She placed a shoulder rocket launcher on the superhero's bicep and did not notice a black and white police car pulled at the curb with lights flashing just behind her.
Kate shot laser beams from the Avenger's eyes, striking down stick figure cops with badges and hats in the street, bleeding dots and dashes. She did not hear the policeman and policewoman with drawn weapons moving through the crowd behind her. Kate pulled a green pen from her ear and made another laser beam shoot from the Progressive Avenger's green eyes into the longest, blackest limousine still walking forward. The green beam penetrated the windshield and the vehicle exploded, caught fire, sending burning bodies in suits flying through the air. "Okay, that's enough."
Kate Kate did not hear the policeman behind her. The progressive Avenger sent green rays into the other vehicles. They exploded. Hey, you come with us. The policeman grabbed Kate under her arms, dragged her to her feet. The police gathered around, cheered, and clapped and pounded their feet on the sidewalk. The policewoman fell to her hands and knees to gather Kate's scattered pens and pens, tossed them into the guitar case. She closed it and brought it with her. She stood holding it next to Kate and her partner, next to the clothing store on the walk. You need to go to the free speech zone, ma'am, over by the tracks. He pointed toward an area a block away, where Kate could see people holding signs. The whole country is a free speech zone, Zeke, said Kate. Can I have that? She reached to her for a guitar case. Thank you. He shook the case to hear the rattling of the pens inside. You can't stop me from being here, said Kate. Yes, we can. The female officer moved in and took Kate by one arm. The television crew set up on the sidewalk as the two officers began to wrestle with Kate. She fought them, trying to free her arms, leaning back against the brick building, letting the guitar case go. Some walkers stopped by to watch. Let me go, Kate screamed. With her right arm, she slammed the woman in the throat, smashing her head against the brick building. Directing her attention to the male officer on her left, she was able to swing with both hands. She struck him in the face with a flurry of elbows and fists. Nose, eyes, mouth, chin. The television reporter signaled her cameraman to begin filming the fight behind him. The woman officer pulled herself from the sidewalk and climbed onto Kate's back. Kate stood up and turned, slamming her rider again into the unforgiving bricks. The TV camera lights shined bright in the dusk. The light caught Kate full in the face. She could see on the edges the forms, shapes of a crowd. Behind it, the motorcade with horns blaring, more lights splashing, flags waving. The crowd roared its approval of the limousines in the parade as the story developed behind their backs. The woman cop wilted. Arms and hands from the crowd reached in toward Kate like ghouls in a nightmare. Kate snatched up her case and charged through the mass. Later that night, the 10 o'clock news broadcast showed Kate darting, dodging, stumbling, running, getting away, with her cape streaming.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO National TV NFL season opener national anthem singers are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for listening. We hope you'll stop by again next week, same time, same place. We'd like to thank WorldNewsTrust.com, TheSpiritualUN.org, and June2508.com, who help us to bring the show to you. If you'd like to help, feel free to leave a donation at our website, theshow.newamericandream.info. We thank you for being here, and I'd like to thank you, Mike, for these great scripts that you write and for being my co-host on the show. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm down there, and good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer, and good night, Barbara Olson. Wherever you are.
Oh.